When your furnace or air conditioner quits, you need it fixed, fast. This is Dennis Sullivan, president of CARE Heating and Cooling. Our technicians are paid to fix your HVAC system, not sell you a new one. We show up on time, diagnose the problem, and get you comfortable again, without the high-pressure sales pitch. It's our commitment to honesty and craftsmanship that helped us win the Lennox Partner of the Year Award and a BBB Torch Award for Ethics last year. So, call CARE Heating and Cooling at 1-800-COOLING or book an appointment online at careheatingandcooling.com. When you need a company you can trust.
Did you know you can save up to 70% on the best brands just by shopping at FromRebel.com? We're talking about strollers, car seats, high chairs, espresso machines, cookware, everything you need for way less. Here's how it works. Every single day, Rebel drops thousands of new products on the site for up to 70% off. It is a constant stream of endless deals from top brands like Upa Baby, Nuna, Baby Bjorn, Breville, Nespresso, KitchenAid, Le Creuset, and more. But you have to act fast because every deal is one of a kind. So if you see something you love, make sure you add to cart fast. So stop paying full price when you don't have to. Whether it's baby gear, kitchen upgrades, or a treasure for your home you didn't know you needed, Rebel has it for way less, up to 70% less. Shop from Rebel.com and save big.
If he's exercising that power that Trump says he's doing, says that I's doing, and then what Elon says he's doing, then he is basically the chief operating officer of the United States, and he basically can countermand. He reports directly to the president, and not only that, he can tell cabinet agencies what to do. That's somebody who has to be confirmed by the Senate to an office created by the Congress of the United States, period.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to George Conway Explains It All to Sarah. I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark. And because I'm not a lawyer, I've asked my good friend George Conway to explain all the illegal news to me, because it is all illegal.
Right. It's all illegal. Virtually all of it. I can't think of any that's legal.
Well, you know, here's the thing. Part of the reason that I think we're dealing with so much illegal news, Donald Trump gave us a tweet over the weekend that laid out his framework for how he thinks about the law. He went to Truth Social.
He is the law.
X and said, "He who saves his country does not violate any law," which is a quotation typically attributed to Napoleon.
So you and I are not violating any law. I think we're good.
Because we are saving the country.
Right.
This is one of those things where, like, the law. This is what's interesting, right? And maybe you could probably explain this better than I can.
In like a Rashomon.
The law is a precise thing, right? Whereas it is subjective, the idea that one is saving one's country. We do believe that we are in the right.
Yes.
And that what we are doing is an attempt to beat back an attack on liberal democracy. But Trump believes that he's saving the country.
Right.
Sure.
So here's the rub. He doesn't think there's anybody else in the world other than him.
Right.
Because he is the world's ultimate narcissist. So in his universe, he is the only person, and he is certainly the only person that matters. We don't really exist. We are just sort of objects of, you know, we're like the trees outside. And so therefore, he can violate no laws because he is the law. He interprets the law. And not only that, according to Napoleon, apparently that is allegedly a quote from Napoleon translated from the French, which obviously he does not speak. He is saving the country. And therefore, I mean, from Sleepy Joe, who was out there just running amok over everything because he was so energetic. And he is saving the country. Therefore, he can violate no laws, which is convenient because he is the one who gets to decide whether he's violating any laws. So he's already decided it. We don't need a legal system. We don't need a constitution. It's done. Life is very easy in the world of Trump.
So I understand why
does
Donald
that all make
Trump,
sense?
Of course it does. And and Donald Trump tweeting this
he's
or putting this out there, that makes total sense that this guy would do that. That's who he is. It's not shocking to us that this is his view of
correct
the law. However,
yes,
what I wanted to ask you about, and because this is something that I think our listeners, it might be tough to appreciate. It's there's Trump, and then there is the whole world that you and I grew up in from people who called themselves constitutional conservatives.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I remember them.
Right? And yeah. This is the kind of thing. I don't know how much more deeply I could express this sentiment being anathema to the entire conservative legal community, philosophical community, like every think tank, everybody would, this would have been singularly alone disqualifying to the people who were our colleagues for so many years. So can you explain I want to know why people aren't more alarmed by this in the conservative legal community.
Well, I mean, it's sort of an interesting thing because I had a conversation yesterday with a friend who was not part of the conservative legal movement. And I'm going to be very careful about how I describe these people so as not to divulge your confidence. But I thought it was interesting. This person I was speaking to was not a liberal. Okay, but is not a conservative on me, but is a very sensible liberal, a middle of the road liberal who has respect for a lot of conservative lawyers, has a very prominent role in the litigation system here in Washington, D.C., and does appellate work and so on. And that person, I call that person to ask about a colleague of that person's who was working in the administration, also very smart, very younger, but very, very similarly situated in terms of professional pedigree. And I said, how could that person do that? I knew that person from private practice. I knew both of them. I knew some of my other people from many years ago. And I thought the other person, the younger person, was a sensible conservative and honorable and decent. And that person is now working in the administration. I'm not going to say where, but it's a reasonably prominent position in the administration. Most people couldn't identify that person. But, and I said, how can that person do that? And, you know, the ultimate answer was ambition. That younger person went to Mar-a-Lago and kissed the ring and is now in a position to affect matters. And, you know, it was very, very disappointing to me because I thought that person was, you know, honorable and sensible. But the only game in town for a conservative lawyer like that, who has ambitions, maybe wants to become a judge, is through this administration. And so that's that person's story. At the same time, the non-conservative person I was talking to has some work that a person does with another lawyer who has been in the conservative legal movement, a very prominent lawyer, a very conservative constitutionalist, and you would recognize this name. And the person I was talking to, the non-conservative person, I should just give them names, said of this stalwart, longtime conservative constitutionalist whose name you would recognize, that person's very upset about Trump, is disgusted by Trump, despises Trump, but has never gone publicly on the record about that, and thinks that Trump, you know, the Constitution, sadly, was not designed to deal with such a person, and that we are in grave, grave danger. But that person doesn't speak out. And why? You know, I'd love to ask that person. I don't know. I can't. And that's where we are. We have people who are deciding that the only way for their advancement is through the administration, and other people who are appalled by it, but who remain silent. Maybe for professional reasons, maybe because they think they can't have an effect, maybe because they don't want to lose friends on the right. I don't know. And that's sort of the schism that we see on the right. And then there are a few lawyers who basically have come out, you know, like the members of the Society for the Rule of Law. A lot of them actually are Reagan administration veterans. I think there is a generational.
Yeah.
I think there is actually a generational split. The most vocal people about how appalling Trump is are people who were in the Justice Department or were in the legal, you know, were young hotshots in the 80s and early 90s. And then there's a group that just kind of exhausted itself, and they're a lot quieter. And then there's the young group where people, I think, maybe are tuned out, or they decided they're not part of this movement, or they are part of the movement and they've quietly gone along with it, or they've just decided, I need to make money for my family, and so I'm just going to hang out at, I don't know, pick a law firm, pick your Covington or Arlington Porter, Arnold Porter, any of your usual suspect law firms, and I'm just going to, you know, I just have to do my thing because I can't do it in government service right now, and I may never be able to, and I have a family and I have mouths to feed. So that's where, does that answer your question? That's my best description of the typography of conservative lawyerdom.
Yeah, so that answers part of my question, really on sort of the individual motivations. But what do you do, like the Federalist Society gathers, how do they look each other in the eye? And how do they evaluate somebody who's openly flouting the rule of law?
I'm sorry, I'm answering your question before you finished it. I'm not the right person to ask that question because I have not gone to a Federalist Society event in a number of years. I did when we first formed Society for the Rule of Law in its original 1.0 incarnation called Checks and Balances. You know, I went to the Federalist Society event that year, and I got a lot of positive feedback from young lawyers, but including some in the administration. And I actually learned from one of those young lawyers that I had a lot of fans. This was 2018, as you may recall, because you were very helpful in the formation of Checks and Balances. I had fans, apparently, of my Twitter feed in the freaking White House counsel's office because they were the ones dealing with the lunacy there. But it's exhausting to me to sort of go and just talk to these people. Other people have done it. Some of our mutual friends have done it. They have maintained their contacts. And, you know, I think we should maybe have some of those people on to see what they say about it. And I do think we're getting some people back at the Principals First Conference is this weekend. And I'm really kind of pleased to see that, you know, Chris Christie was never a Federalist Society type, but he's going to speak. We're getting some of these people back, I think. I think we're going to get some more back, but I do think most people are just going to just sort of ride it out and just hope for the best. And, you know, at this point, I don't know that they can do anything that's helpful.
Let's talk about some people who are doing something helpful. Because last week, right, we talked a lot about the federal prosecutors of New York Mayor Eric Adams and the subsequent resignations of the interim U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, Danielle Sassoon, who, you know, we should get her to come to Principals First because that is a real Principals First move she did there. But while we were recording last week...
My understanding is she doesn't intend...
she's not going to do anything public.
Podcast, but my understanding, like third hand, is that she's not doing any public appearances. That may be because she happened to be 8.5 months pregnant when all this happened. Maybe just like, you know, she wants to sort of, being an activist wasn't the life she wants to lead. She wanted to be a hardworking federal prosecutor putting bad guys in jail, and now she can't do that. And she's got kids and, going out on the hustings and giving speeches is, you know, not a lot of people want to really do that. And, I can't really blame people like that. But somebody's got to get out there. And it shouldn't just, we need more people out there to do it. On the other hand, at the end of the day, the time to do that was a few years ago. We're now sort of at the point where, as I've said, marching in the streets is the likely outcome.
All right. But before we get to marching in the streets, like I said, last week while we were recording, it dropped. And we talked about it slightly when it was breaking, but Assistant U.S. Attorney Hagan Scotton, who's in charge of the prosecution, resigned. And I read a short excerpt of his resignation letter. But I feel like this deserves a little bit more airtime. And it's worth noting that Hagan Scotton clerked for Kavanaugh, and he was on the D.C. Circuit, and then, or when he was on the D.C. Circuit, so he clerked for Kavanaugh then, and then he also clerked for Chief Justice Roberts. So, like, right. We are not talking about some random squish, but I just want to read right. the full no thing squish. Of what he wrote. He said, there is a tradition in public service of resigning in a last-ditch effort to head off a serious mistake. Some will view the mistake you are committing here in the light of their generally negative views of the new administration. I do not share those views. Meaning he's not just like reflexively negative on the administration.
Right. He's kind of saying he's a little bit of a Trumper there.
Yeah. So he's saying that up front.
Kind of defending the president when you get to the next couple sentences.
I can even understand how a chief executive whose background is in business and politics might see the contemplated dismissal with leverage as a good if distasteful deal. But any assistant U.S. attorney would know that our laws and traditions do not allow using the prosecutorial power to influence other citizens, much less elected officials in this way. If no lawyer within earshot of the president
read that. The next sentence is important. I'm sorry.
If no lawyer within earshot of the president is willing to give him that advice, then I expect you will eventually find someone who is enough of a fool or enough of a coward to file your motion. But it was never going to be me.
That's a remarkable series of four sentences. He interweaves, you know, this defense that, look, I am not anti-Trump. I think Trump probably doesn't know any better because people are giving him bad advice. Now, I disagree with that because I think Trump, you know my position. My position is obviously not this man's position. My position is Trump is a sociopath. He's a criminal. He seeks the advice he wants to seek. He doesn't find any of this distasteful because he has no moral judgment. But this fellow is at least for purposes of this letter and probably to some extent in his own mind, maybe completely in his own mind, excuses the president the way a lot of people do, which is, well, he's just getting bad advice. Like, I know somebody whose name I won't mention, but you probably know who it is, who kept saying, oh, the wrong people kept going in there. And, you know, he listened to these bad people, kept getting access to him during the run-up to January 6th. Like, no. He let those people in, and he ignored the people who were telling him what the law actually was. But that said, it's a remarkable thing that this fellow did here to say, no, this is really, really bad. I'm not going to blame it on the big guy. I'm going to blame it on the people in between. You, Mr. Bove, and the other people who are either not there or there, but not failing to give the president the advice that I know he would take, which is, I know he'd obey the law if I told him that, well, this is the law. And, it's a sort of a remarkable thing. It strengthens his argument in a way, because it gives it, he's trying to bolster his credibility on the right by saying, I'm not an anti-Trumper. I'm a pro-Trumper. I just think he's being misled. And, it's at once schizophrenic, yet at the same time, it's powerful. Does that make any sense to you?
Oh, it makes sense. And I think it's tough for sometimes people like us, I think, who were like, oh, I'm sorry. You. Donald Trump has been telling you this is what he wants the whole time, and you still supported him, and so it gets very frustrating. At the same time, there's just no doubt that as a messenger, as a person with sort of Trumpian, like he doesn't have TDS like us. He's not out to get Trump, and he's letting Trump off the hook while at the same time making it 100% clear that what is happening is wrong, is against the law, is not what his job is. And so his resignation is
I want to buy this guy a bottle of whiskey for what he did here. Okay. And I'll basically put aside our disagreement on Trump being a sociopath and a criminal for this, because for what he did here was just absolutely magnificent.
And
And all the more brave, almost.
It is. Because, you know, basically.
Because he's standing up to his own side, the side that he believes he's on.
Correct. It's particularly brave because he's like that person I talked about, but didn't name earlier, who sought advancement because that person's only means of advancement to a judgeship or whatever was to kiss the ring at Mar-a-Lago. But this guy probably was on that same track, but he chose the path of honor in the end. And I cannot, you know, I mean, it brings tears to my eyes, but what really brings tears to my eyes is there have not been enough of those people during the last 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
Because there were plenty of occasions, not quite as dramatic as this, where people could have done it, you know, could have quit in protest. And, you know, the best example I always thought was Rod Rosenstein. He had plenty of occasions to basically say, this is wrong. This, what you're writing here, Bill Barr, this letter purporting to summarize Special Counsel Mueller's report is mendacious. And he could have at that point resigned and said, I disagree, and made a noisy withdrawal. And there are other moments where he could have stood up to the president, but instead, at one point, he came crying to the White House in tears, saying, please don't fire me. Please don't fire me. Literally, remember that?
Vaguely, now that you're saying it.
What? You remember?
Only now that you're saying it. I'd forgotten about all this.
He was in tears, and he came to the White House, and he was begging to keep his job. And this is a guy who, very early on in the administration, according to multiple witnesses, said, this guy's freaking crazy. Somebody's got to invoke the 25th Amendment. He concluded that.
I remember defending Rosenstein. Right. I remember running ads defending Rosenstein in the early days.
I had always thought, and I met the guy too during all of this, because he spends his summers in South Jersey near where my ex-wife's shore house was. And one time he came over in his detail with his wife. And, you know, and I was like really admiring of him because I thought he was the one guy who was going to stand up. And in the end, he was a coward. And we haven't heard anything from him since. And he was an example of somebody, you know, and the irony about it is if you want to, if you're purely career oriented, he was never going to get another job. Okay. Because Trump didn't like him enough. If you were purely just motivated by self-promotion, he could have become a national hero by resigning under fire or in protest at one of many things he probably could have taken objection to. You know, he could have grandstanded. He didn't do that. I guess that in some way is admirable. But what he did in the end was just cowardly, I thought. And I hate to say it because I think he's a nice guy, but he didn't want to, you know. I don't know that he would have done what these people have did. Maybe he would have. Maybe under these unusual circumstances, he would have done what these assistant U.S. attorneys did. I don't know.
I don't know. His circumstances were pretty unusual and he could have done something. I do want to actually, just in remarking on these people again, remember as we were talking about this, there's this thing where we heard Emile Bove, right, who was the lawyer, or Bove, I don't really know how you pronounce
Bove,
his name.
It's Bove.
But he dragged all of the...
I like to call him Thug-A.
Okay.
Thug-A.
Thug-E.
Oh, sorry.
No. It's we heard that they were, this guy's dragging all these people at DOJ into an office and being like, go and file this motion or we're going to fire you.
Fire each and every one of you. Yeah.
So nobody
did. You know
did.
What he did yesterday?
What?
You know, the argument before Judge Ho on the motion to dismiss the joint motion or the motion to dismiss the Adams case. Was held, and after the argument, I read, he went out and, you know, he spoke to the press out on, I guess it was either, probably 500, right in front of 500 Pearl Street, where the people come out of the of the metal detectors in the courthouse, and the press is assembled there as they usually do for big cases. And he basically said that anybody who wants to, who disagrees with anything we have to say, I'm paraphrasing, and our, any position of the Justice Department, I understand that there are draft resignation letters available on the websites of the New York Times and some other paper that you can just fill out. I mean, basically just telling everybody who has a conscience and who has commitment to the rule of law to get out of the Justice Department. And, you know, I think there are going to be a lot of people who are just going to do that. I mean, it's hard because you have to find a job and the job market's going to be flooded with people. But I know a couple of friends of mine. There are a couple of people I know who are at the FBI, a couple, and they're resigning. Okay, they don't want to work for Kash Patel. And, you know, it's sort of interesting. The collateral effects are going, maybe I'm going off on a tangent here, but I think this is interesting. The collateral effects of these resignations are going to make it harder for Mr. Thug, to enforce the edicts of the king. Because who's going to litigate all this shit? They're getting sued multiple times a day. They're probably upward. I mean, I saw a count yesterday that there are 70-something lawsuits. And they're probably, it's probably more than that at this point. They got to send lawyers out to defend all of these cases. And how many good ones are they going to have? They're not going to be all like that one, the one I mentioned, an Earl nameless person who actually is talented. There are not that many good lawyers out there who want to work for this Justice Department.
Right.
And, you know, they're going to have a problem, which is one reason why I think at the end of the day, they're just not going to bother. They're going to lose a bunch of these cases. They're just going to ignore the results.
So just putting a button on the Bove thing, he ultimately couldn't find somebody to deliver to drop the prosecution. He had to go in and do it himself, which I just think is a nice little end to that particular story.
Yeah, I mean, there was one guy who volunteered to sign the paper, but I think they couldn't, you know, I mean, how are you going to send that guy there? He clearly doesn't believe it. And the judge is going to say, what's your position? Well, you know, he's going to say, he probably would have said, well, I'm told to say this. Well, you would have been apparent that he wasn't buying into it. So Bove went down himself, I guess, to his credit in some sense, to take, I mean, if you're going
to
wear, be
not to his credit. It's the,
you know, no. If you're going to be dishonorable, you might as well be.
There's no one else to do it. Everyone else is.
Yeah. No. You know, so
yeah.
Reversely too. So, you know, here we are.
I think a lot of people feel very, you know, right now, like downtrodden and like nobody's doing anything and nobody's standing up. I think people should at least take a little bit of courage, you know, a little bit of, I think it should pick people up that Bove had to go in and do it himself because people resigned and nobody was willing to do it.
But yeah,
we're starting
I agree with
the
you.
Beginnings of some spine.
And I think we're going to see more over time. I wish we had seen more earlier. I wish we had seen more over the past several years, but I do think he's pushing people to this administration is pushing people to the breaking point. The problem is they are ensconced and, you know, it's going to be a pitched battle in some way. It's going to be, you know, whether it takes the form of civil disobedience, litigation, protests, it's going to be a pitched battle. And, you know, we don't know. We're dealing with a government that we cannot assume won't engage in essentially criminal conduct, whether it be through the use of force or just simply, you know, doing dishonest things that would ordinarily put people in jail themselves, put public officials in jail.
Speaking of dishonest things that could put people in jail, let's talk about Elon Musk and Doge.
Yeah.
Doge. There's been a lot of back and forth about whether Elon is actually the head of Doge or not. This has been like an interesting side conversation that has more relevance than people might think. So on Monday, the White House filed a declaration in one of the cases against Doge, asserting that Elon is senior advisor to the president, comparing Elon to Anita Dunn, President Biden's advisor at the White House. Now, in the court filing, the White House said, in his role as senior advisor to the president, Mr. Musk has no greater authority than any other senior White House advisor. Mr. Musk is an employee of the White House. He is not an employee of the U.S. Doge service. Okay, that's interesting, because then Trump gave a speech yesterday and said, I signed an order creating the Department of Efficiency and put a man named Elon Musk in charge. Can you just explain why it matters whether Elon is the head of Doge or just a White House advisor?
Well, I'll set aside the fact that somebody's lying here.
Yeah.
And we'll go back. Somebody not telling the truth here.
Right.
But to go back to this, this is, goes back to a discussion we had last week. If he is the head of Doge, well, Doge, what is Doge doing? Doge is basically, he and Doge are basically bossing around the, you know, the various cabinet agencies, and cabinet officials are basically subordinating themselves to him, this man who, you know, is holding joint press conferences with the president of the United States, remarkably. And that would mean that he can't just be an employee of the United States. Let's leave aside whether he's an employee of Doge. Okay, that would mean he has to be constitutionally an officer of the United States because he's exercising significant authority. And an officer has to be someone who is appointed at least by the president or somebody to an office created by law. And this office has not been created by law, i.e., by legislation passed by Congress, both houses of Congress, and signed by the president. Okay? This agency, the DOGE, is a repurposed agency within the executive office of the presidency. It used to be called the United States Digital Service. I'm not sure what it did before. I think it might have had something to do with the Obamacare website way back in the day. But it's just this thing that was in the executive office of the president, created by executive order and not by any statute. Okay? And it is, you know, the employee in charge of it, or the officer in charge of it the person in charge of it is not an officer, cannot be an officer, cannot exercise the power of an officer under the Constitution, because that position in being in charge of this Doge, which used to be this other thing, was not created by law and by an enactment of Congress. That's problem number one. Problem number two is that officers who are not inferior officers under the Constitution, which means they report to somebody who reports to the president, right? Like the attorney general is not an inferior officer because Pam Bondi is subordinate only to the president. So she is not an inferior officer. And what the Constitution says about cabinet-type officials or heads of departments, in essence, is that they must not only be appointed by the president, but confirmed by the Senate of the United States with the advice and consent of the Senate, the famous words in the Constitution. So Elon Musk, I mean, problem number one is he can't exercise authority that's significant in the executive branch if he's not an officer, and he can't be an officer because his office wasn't created by law. That's problem one. But it gets worse. The Constitution says that that inferior officers can be appointed by the president, don't have to be confirmed by Congress, okay, by the Senate. But if you are exercising the authority of a non-inferior officer, in other words, you are not reporting to another officer, you're reporting, say, directly to the president, like the attorney general, the secretary of defense, the secretary of the treasury, the director of Office of Management and Budget. If you are head of a department and you report directly to the president, you are by definition, zillions of cases interpreting the Constitution's appointment clause, you are not an inferior officer. You are what the cases call a principal officer. You are the head of a department. And principal officers
must be appointed by the president, nominated by the president, and confirmed by the Senate of the United States with the advice and consent of the Senate, is the language that the Constitution uses. And of course, Elon is not that either. So these are two very, very strong and I think bulletproof arguments that would say that if Elon is exercising this kind of authority that it is alleged that he is alleging and that President Trump and Elon Musk himself are asserting that he is alleging, okay, that he is exercising, excuse me, not alleging. If he is exercising that power that Trump says he's doing, says that I'm doing, and then what Elon says he's doing, then he is basically the chief operating officer of the United States, and he basically can countermand. He reports directly to the president, and not only that, he can tell cabinet agencies what to do. That's somebody who has to be confirmed by the Senate to an office created by the Congress of the United States, period.
Now I'm telling you what I think of the declaration where they're saying,
He's just like Anita Dunn. He's just a regular employee. He's not even an employee of Doge. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
That's just a series of fucking lies, unless it turns out he really isn't doing anything and this is all a public relations fake out and nothing is actually happening at Doge, which we know not to be true because people are getting pink slips left and right.
Yeah, we know that's not true because they're finding that they're out there confusing millions with billions. Firing everybody.
The National Nuclear Security Administration. Oops. Hey, I'm transporting
a nuclear weapon. I just got fired. What am I supposed to do? Just leave it at the truck stop?
I don't know exactly what they do.
If it weren't so scary, this story would be funny.
And I were trying to look for things to cut, and I come across this office that says National Nuclear Security Agency. I probably would stop and say, hey, what do these guys do? Is it important?
Okay, you got me really chinned up. Sorry. Sorry.
What was that tweet? There was like the guy who was like, can somebody contact me if you just happen to have the nuclear weapons lying around? Because I'd really like to be a nuclear state.
There was a blue sky post where some guy tweets or posts that says, hi, if you're one of these nuclear security guys and you got fired and you were transporting a nuclear weapon, you know, feel free to bring it over to me. I have a big backyard and I've always wanted to be a nuclear power.
Here's the thing. It would be funny if it weren't so insane. Because here's the other thing. They fired all those guys and now they can't find people to hire them back. Because,
There's another one, people are saying, well, we don't have to worry about unemployment because they could just fire everybody at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. To which I responded like, oh yeah, that's just like what Trump, remember what Trump used to say during COVID? He'd say, well, the reason why we have so many COVID cases is because we're testing so much. You know, if we didn't test so much, we wouldn't have so many cases. So screw it. Let's not have labor statistics. There'll be no unemployment. A bird flu. You know, just try to find some eggs at the store. They're like 8 bucks a...
Yeah, man. Egg prices are not going down. And in fact, look, this is like talk about a tangent. It's not even... But Donald Trump is... just if people are looking for some legitimate good news, because we've been pretty dark lately, his poll numbers are starting to fall, like pretty quickly. And one of the places they're starting to fall precipitously is on the economy, which is interesting. Because I think that there was a sense from people that maybe the economy was more about vibes and like people weren't really feeling the pain that they were feeling under Biden because there's this sense of like, well, maybe it's just because Trump is saying that the economy is bad. But actually, there's still a lot of people who do not feel like the economy is good. And so Trump is not getting good marks for that. And he's not getting good marks on is whether or not he's focused on that. Like, people are like, wait, he's not, this is like the one thing I wanted him to do and he's not focused on it.
Right. No, he's focused on, did you see what he's focused on putting more people on the unemployment rolls.
Yeah.
Here in D.C. And not just in D.C. I mean, people say, well, it's just in D.C. It's not true.
85% of the federal government is outside of D.C.
There are little pockets of federal agencies all around the country, you know, which is partly because members of Congress were smart enough to do that. I mean, it's political, but yeah. I mean, you know, when you mail your tax return in, I mean, I think a lot of times people have to mail them into some huge facility in Kansas City, Missouri. There are a lot of federal workers out there, apparently.
Yeah.
All right. And so this is not something, I mean, obviously, the D.C. DMV area, as they call it here, is going to be most very, very badly affected. But this is going to, you know, this has collateral effects. And those people here who feel insecure about their jobs, even if they haven't been fired because they're not probationary employees and they know, realize that at some point they may have to go look for a job, they're going to start spending less money, ordering fewer things on Amazon, for example. And you know, as any economist will tell you, I mean, that has multiplying effects throughout the economy. So we are, no, there's not a lot of reason to be hopeful. And then, of course, there are the crazy tariffs, right? I mean, and people are starting to get that. Well, geez, the Canadians don't want to buy whiskey from Kentucky. Well, that's not good for Kentucky. And, you know, if a lot of industries in Canada, in the United States, and Mexico are joined at the hip. I mean, auto parts to Canada and Canadian manufacturing plants of Ford and GM and vice versa. It's really, really, people are wondering, it's like, what is he doing? Meanwhile, he's very, very, very focused, apparently, on having Elon put the pressure on Boeing and whoever's, you know, whatever, I guess the Defense Department. But he's got to get the next version of Air Force One going, because that is very important to our the king, as you might want to call him.
I'm trying to think about which way to take this conversation, because I need to go back to Doge for a second, but just really quickly on this, like, I think that the reason that the poll numbers are starting to go down, I actually thought it might take longer for people to start feeling the negative personal consequences of what they're doing. But even Elon and Trump are starting to basically say out loud now, you guys are going to, there's going to be pain in the short term. And I think that, in focus groups, I have Kara on the show and we're talking about Elon on Saturday. She knows more about Elon. You know, Elon and Trump were both these like cultural figures that I didn't pay attention to because I didn't care about them and actually found them sort of repellent in general.
Right.
But they have a lot of mainstream purchase and I don't notice them until they break the plane of politics.
Right.
And then suddenly I'm like, okay, why do people like this guy? And so I did a bunch of focus groups where I asked people about Elon and what they liked about him and also what they were not fans of about him. And I'll tell you, you guys are going to have to listen to the show to find out what they liked about him. One of the things they don't like about him is the fact that they're like, what does this guy get out of this? Like, why is he all in the government? And there's a little bit of a thing about communications is that you're not trying to convince somebody of something they don't believe. You're actually trying to unlock something they kind of believe.
True deep down. Absolutely.
And so people have this archetype in their bellies of like the crazy evil billionaire who's in it. There's like some nefarious purpose. And so there's like a strain of real skepticism about what Elon is doing from some of these Trump voters, and they were all Trump voters. And so I wanted to ask you though, like with the Elon thing you just laid out, I thought very efficiently and effectively, like the complex or like why it is a conflict and why it's right now, like if he's in this role, then he has to be Senate confirmed. If he's not Senate confirmed, he shouldn't be able to do these things that he's doing. But how are the courts ultimately going to like get a handle on this? Because one of the things people say in focus groups is he wouldn't be allowed to do it if it was illegal.
Yeah, I mean, that is a really, really important concept. And, I've been talking to some experts in authoritarian takeovers of democratic governments, like Professor Kim Shepelit of Princeton University, who study very closely the course of development of the authoritarian regimes in Hungary, which remains in effect with Orban, and in Poland, which got turned out in the last election. And
one of the things that's different between Poland and Hungary is that in Hungary, everybody just accepted, well, it's legal. This is legal. Whereas in Poland, the opposition made a big deal about how everything was illegal. And I think, you know, I have been saying that one of the things that Trump is going to do is to start disobeying court orders. I think right now he's kind of doing it under the table, as partly in, you know, maybe intentionally, but partly also because the government is completely in chaos. I think at some point he's just going to say, as we discussed last week, that, you know, it's not for anybody to tell me what to do. And there's a little flavor of that in an executive order he issued, I think, just the night before last.
Yeah.
So what I think is really important is that we need to keep banging the drums every time they lose a case. They're not going to lose all of them, but they're going to lose a lot of them. They're going to lose, to my mind, they at some point will lose this Doge case. All right. They didn't get the government, the plaintiffs did not get a TRO from, I think it was Judge Chutkin, but not because, you know, the case doesn't have potential merit. It's just that, you know, there are procedural aspects to early relief, temporary relief. We have to show that something really bad is immediately going to happen that can't be fixed later. And, you know, for example, if somebody gets fired, they can get rehired.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I do think at some point that case, I don't see how the government wins that case. And I think there's going to be some interesting discovery that's going to show that that declaration that you quoted from is, you know, the person who signed that declaration should go to jail, because it's just, I mean, unless there really is, you know, unless it's all just smoke and Doge doesn't really exist and Elon and Trump are just yapping about something that isn't happening, which just is inconsistent with what anybody could possibly perceive as being reality, given all the things that are happening in the federal government. I mean, that affidavit is just, you read some of those words. It can't be true. And I mean, Big Balls is somebody's telling Big Balls, that kid that from, I don't know, is he at SpaceX or where Elon got him. Somebody's telling Big Balls what to do.
Right.
And I don't think it's Donald Trump. And we'll find out who it is. And that's one of the great things about litigation is you can find stuff out. You could smoke some of this stuff out. It takes a while sometimes.
Well, this is the thing about, you know, when I hear these voters being like, well, they wouldn't let them do it if it was illegal. And there's part of me that's like, it's just like with the other cases that we dealt with. It's just like this stuff takes such a long time. It's like the Trumps, why Trump wasn't convicted in any of these
well,
things.
Well, I mean, partly
is
that's because, you know, I'll say it now. I was kind about it for a couple of years because Merrick Garland just did not get off the stick for 18, 19, 20 months.
Do you want to talk about some of those executive orders, that executive order? Because he is issuing, you know, a barrage of executive orders.
I mean,
and I wanted to ask you about the one that was issued on Wednesday called the Ensuring Accountability for All Agencies.
Yeah, that's a very interesting one.
Well, the order says that all executive departments and agencies, including so-called independent agencies shall submit for review all proposed and significant regulatory actions to the Office of the President before publication in the Federal Register. And independent agencies could include agencies like the SEC and the FDIC. Now, the White House has had the power to review the regulations of government agencies since President Clinton signed an executive order calling for regulatory review 30 years ago, but it has always exempted independent regulatory agencies. Is that the big difference now?
Yeah, I mean, this is a question.
Like, what are they trying to do with this executive order? What do you think they're trying to get at?
You have to take a few steps back here about and have to sort of do a little bit of background on executive agencies and the constitutional law regarding executive agencies. And you could literally teach a year-long law school seminar about it. But I'm going to try to do this in 30 seconds. There was a case called Myers against the United States back, I don't know, in the late 19th century, I think, or maybe early 20th, which held that
the president had the right to fire executive officials. And if you think about that, that's important. That's an important power, the power to remove, the removal power for the president to have. Because if the president can't remove an officer or secretary of something or other, that person kind of becomes a little bit independent of the executive. And Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, which is the section, which is the article that governs the executive branch, says right up front in Section 1, the first sentence, the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States. It basically says the law enforcement function, the law execution function is the president's. Then came a period of time where Congress started creating agencies that where they restricted the power of the president to remove officers. And I don't know which was first. And there's a case called Humphrey's Executor. I forget which agency that was. And basically what happened is if you have an agency that's a multi-member agency like the Federal Trade Commission or the Securities and Exchange Commission, the president had the power to appoint with the advice and consent of the Senate, the members of the SEC, I think there are five, the members of the FTC, I think there are five, but could not remove them but for without a particular excuse like for cause, corruption, or something like that. And the court upheld that concept in a case called Humphrey's Executor. And the problem with Humphrey's Executor is it makes, as a policy standpoint, it makes a lot of sense. Like for the Fed, we don't want political, we want to depoliticize the Fed. Because if you start giving the president too much power over the Fed to change monetary policy in advance of an election, you're going to get, this is not how to, there's no way to run a central bank. And that's why the Fed is the quintessential independent agency, even though it technically is, it should be in the executive branch. It's the ideal setup for the bank.
Right.
Because it creates stability. But here's the problem. If Congress did that for every department, like took the Justice Department and made it a multi-member body of co-attorneys general and said that the president couldn't fire him, or the Secretary of Treasury did the same thing to the Treasury, did the same thing to the Defense Department, you could basically strip the president of all his executive power. Because think about the judges, judgeships. Judges can't be removed except by impeachment, right? The reason why that rule exists and why they have life tenure, but let's assume that they had 10-year terms. The reason why the presidents can't remove judges is to preserve their independence. So if you did something like that with the Secretary of Defense and made it the Federal Defense Commission, and you basically strip the president of his commander-in-chief role. That can't be the case. So the problem that the Supreme Court has had from Humphrey's executive to the present is figuring out which side does a particular removal provision, a statute, an agency fall under. Is it Myers, where the president, I think, got to remove the postmaster general? Or is it Humphrey's executor, where there was some multi-member agency, I forget which one, where the president couldn't do that? And I'll be damned if these cases make a lot of sense, but where, in terms of their logic, but where the court has kind of come out thus far is that in a recent case in 2021 or 22 called Celia Law against the CPFB, the court held that if it's a multi-member agency, then it falls under the rubric of Humphrey's executive and the president, the precedent requires us to say that it's okay for Congress to make it hard to remove people. And then if it's a single person agency head like the CPFB was, well, then that, the president has to have the power to remove. And the problem with that is
I don't know that it necessarily makes any sense, and it's not necessarily consistent with Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, because the conservative judges hate it. And where it comes into play here today is that it has been part of the conservative project, even before legal project, even before Trump, to get rid of these independent agencies because they're exercising executive power, and they are not responsible to the executive. And the Constitution says the executive power shall be vested in the President of the United States. The liberals hate that because, you know, it means the president has too much power and can exercise, become, you know, and Trump is the perfect example, the most political, illegal president in history. You know, he wants to control everything in the executive branch. But anyway, Trump has glommed on to this kind of conservative legal theory to try to control every branch, every agency of government, including the independent agencies. And the question is, what's the Supreme Court going to do? Is the Supreme Court finally going to overrule Humphrey's executor? And essentially, the acting Solicitor General, Sarah Harris, wrote a letter basically saying, we will not defend Humphrey's executor. They want to overturn Humphrey's executor. And in ordinary circumstances, I would think, well, I can see the merit of that. But under the current circumstances, it's downright scary.
Well, yeah. I mean, to me, you just went through something that was very wonky, and I can see people maybe being tuning it out. But like, it's important to understand how significant this could be, especially if Trump, let's say, now he's in charge of something like the Fed.
Yeah, the Fed is the paragon of why we want, you know, I don't, you know, the FTC, look, I think the FTC is whacked out, okay? It's crazy that we have two, for example, antitrust enforcement agencies. The DOJ enforces the same laws that the FTC does. If you have a merger, for example, they basically flip a coin to decide whether the merger is going to be reviewed by one agency or another. It's bizarre, okay? It's bizarre. You know, the DOJ can prosecute people for committing securities law violations under the criminal law. The SEC can do it civilly. Why is that? Okay, it's kind of weird. On the other hand, God forbid that the Fed should be under Donald Trump's control or any president's control. Who's, you know, it's like, okay, hey, let's
how we end up like
increase
Zimbabwe.
The money supply it's just because like, turn we're, on, when elections coming yeah. up in 18 months. It's crazy.
That's right.
It's sort of like a problem in the plumbing of the Constitution because they didn't realize when they wrote the document how big the government would necessarily have to become. I mean, I think it's become unnecessarily bigger than it had to be.
Sure.
But, you know, this is a nation of 330 plus million people now with a GNP of how many trillions of dollars and with a currency that basically, you know, on which the world economy fundamentally depends in substantial part. I want to have an independent Federal Reserve Bank. I want an independent central bank.
It's intention. It really is intention with the Constitution.
And now with Trump basically deciding he doesn't want to even follow laws enacted by Congress, okay, when it comes to appropriations money and so on and so forth, it's a disturbing concept that he wants to assert control over absolutely everything because, you know, it's... He has way too many toys already.
Yeah. All right. We've got to leave it there. George, as always, thanks for explaining the illegal news to all of us. Don't forget to hit subscribe, leave us a review, and we'll see you next week.
Well, George Conway, he's a man with a plan. Got to sit down with Sarah Longwell, take a stand, explain all the legal problems they're piling high. With Donald Trump, oh my, oh my, oh my. He said, Sarah, let me break it down for you. There's obstruction of justice, corruption too. The legal tangles and troubles, they're growing fast. It's a storm that's gonna last.